So while you're turning your Bibles to Judges chapter 3, the following notice was sent home with some high school students. Our school's cross-graded, multi-ethnic, individualized learning program is designed to enhance the concept of an open-ended learning program on the continuum of multi-ethnic, academically enriched learning, using the identified intellectually gifted child as the agent of his own learning. One parent sent back a note that read, "I have a college degree and speak 2 foreign languages and 4 Indian dialects, but I haven't the faintest idea what you're talking about. Has our communication become so loaded with babblespeak that no one understands what we're saying?" So if you're in the book of Judges, let's see, what verse should I pick to make Randy's date be or entry be wrong if he's already written it out? No, it's Judges 3:23. Judges 3:23. And it says, "And that, then Ehud went forth through the porch, shut the doors of the parlor behind him, or upon him, and locked them." So, one of the things that I thought about when doing this is, I don't know how you read the Bible. Maybe for you it's just words. I try to make a movie out of it in my mind a lot of times when I'm reading it. So, I'm just thinking, I don't know about you, but you're one guy. You're special, you're left-handed, so that right there, you know, a lot of people have some viewpoints about left-handed people, especially in antiquity. And if you really want to know what you are, by the way, just as a word of thing, take your hands, put your hands together, and whatever thumb is on top, that is the side that you're naturally dominant. That's the way God made you to be what-handed you are, most of the time. So in my case, if I do it, I'm left-handed. Now, I knew I was left-handed because I remember going to school and they would take the pen or pencil out of the left hand and they would put it in the right hand and keep doing that until you stopped, which for some of us was a little bit longer period of time than the others. That's just the way it goes. But think of on this particular case of Ehud, he's doing what God wants him to do. Now, I just want you to think about, could you imagine going to most of America today, read the story of Ehud and said, this is God's will for his life, that he's going to go and he's going to kill this very fat man. You ever thought about that? How many places today, if you went into a church service, would have the gall to tell you that God sent somebody to go kill someone? I mean, just one person. We're not even talking about killing a whole nation at this point or any of that kind of stuff. We're just talking about one person. How many people would be offended and say there is something wrong with your God? I mean, let's just be real and honest with where we are at in America today, that it is not within America's concept of God to have a God that would send somebody to go assassinate somebody. Not only that, have you thought about Ehud's position? He's being sent for all purposes as a SEAL team of one, and you're going to go in there and you're going to kill this guy. And by the way, you're going to be in the middle of the capital city and in the middle of all this, and then so it's a one-way trip. I mean, you'd have to assume that you're thinking this is a one-way trip. You're going in. I mean, it's not like you're just going to the outskirts of some little, you know, mountain little town, and you're going to kill off some minor mayor of like a city of 150 people. You're going into where the king is. Not only going where the king is, it's probably in the center of town. You've got all of these people around you everywhere. He's got all these servants, all these other things. It would be normal to assume that you're not going to get away with it. It would be even normal to assume that you're not sure that you're even going to accomplish what you're setting out to do. I don't know about you, but there's a lot of times I've set out on jobs and it's like, yeah, I'm not sure if I'm going to pull this one off. You know, and by God's grace, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But think about the position of Ehud in this case. Have you ever thought about what it must have been like after he put the blade in? It's now time to leave. How loud would every beat of your heartbeat be in your ear? You know, you're strained to hear, "Have I been caught? Have they figured out what I did yet?" Because you have to pretty much assume all of the servants knew who was in with the king last. This is public information. It's not like there we'd be going, well, there's just, we don't know who was in there. Just some ninja dropped out of the sky with a parachute and killed him. And then we don't know how they got out. They would have seen him come in. They would have seen him come out. On top of that, have you ever thought about what it must have been for him to walk out of there? I mean, I don't know about you. The closest thing I can think about, and this isn't 100% right, but have you ever like stole anything out of the cookie jar? And when you, and we've talked in detail before about how, you know, that's a skill that you have to master, how to, especially with those ceramic and clay ones, because they make lots of noise and you got to practice that. That is not something you just want to, you know, pick it up and do. But imagine him, he's walking out of there. I'm sure he's trying to walk real quiet. I'm sure he is really trying to shut that door quiet-like. And but also he's trying to not make it look like he's guilty and he's done something bad. And you have all these competing emotions going through your body and through your mind as you're trying to walk out of there. And we know that there weren't any servants around that area. He'd sent them far off. And so here he was, he's in there and he's, you know, shutting that door nice and gently and softly. And then he's then what does he have to walk through? He may have to walk through a garden. We talked about this last week, that it's very possible that there was a whole garden around this building that he was in. So he's walking through the garden. There could have been all sorts of animals and stuff in there because they like to have the kings like to have their own zoos. You know, it reminds me of when my mom and dad, after they got married, my dad took my mom to reptile gardens in South Dakota. Now, my mom does not like snakes. Actually, she doesn't like most reptiles. So I'm not sure what my dad was thinking or not in this particular case. And everything was pretty good until they decided to go into the inner area because they had snakes that would climb up the trees and hang down. And yeah, that part of the little whole honeymoon did not go over well. But can you imagine walking through this garden, hearing all these exotic animals and who knows what's up in the trees and making these noises and things like that? How uneasy would you be? How would you feel with your heart pounding? You know what you did. You know they're going to find out at some point in time. And you're walking through this garden that, it, let's face it, this may be the only the second time that you've been there. Because you'll walk through once and you're walking back out. And by the way, you don't want to get lost out there. Because the longer you spend in the garden, the more likely you are to get caught. And I don't know if there's a maze or all these other paths. Maybe it was a straight path through. I don't know. I'm just trying to make you put yourself in the position of Ehud and what he was thinking. Could you imagine just every time he crossed somebody, seeing them look at him and him wondering, are they going to be the one that's going to raise the alarm? Are they going to be the one that's going to try to come and grab and apprehend me? His ears strained to hear in the distance some cry of alarm, some cry of that the king is dead, and some cry that they need to come and find the bad guy. Well, he's the bad guy that they'd be looking for. And you're walking through the palace area. I mean, even once you get out of the palace area, you still now have to walk through all the city. And as we'll read about, it's very likely there were guards and other people walking through that city. You know, the modern day police. There to keep law and order and all those other things. So everywhere he's going, he's still in the mass of all these people trying to get out of there. And all these eyes are looking at him. He's hearing all the stuff going on. And that, all that fear that goes on in the heart of man of where he's at. Have you ever thought about where Ehud is at all the way through this? I think that's important why some of the words are in there the way they are. Turn over to Judges 3, chapter 3, verse 24. When he was gone out, his servants came. And when they saw that, behold, the doors of the parlor were locked, they said, surely he covereth his feet in his slumber chamber. You know, he's just having a good nap. You know, it's been a little bit hot out in the days, and, you know, he's had a big schedule. And I am pretty sure with all the way he liked to eat food that siestas were a normal part of his way of life. And we talked a little bit about that last week. I am pretty sure Eglon has probably berated his servants at some point or nine for interrupting him and his peace and, you know, all the things that are going on. That's why they're like, ooh, what do we do? it's locked. Okay, we better leave him alone. Why? Because they've probably been yelled at for walking in and interrupting whatever he's doing. I don't know. Maybe he's up there flicking through the channels and his favorite show's on. Maybe he's binge-watching something on Netflix. I'm not sure what he's doing in the palace out there in the middle of summer, but, obviously the thing is that there's reasons why they were trying to convince themselves not to go in. Now, could it have been God? Absolutely. But it could just as well have been his leadership style. See, that's one of the things when you're in leadership is how you treat your people that work for you is going to come back. You treat them poorly and you treat them in a way that you berate them and all this other stuff, and they're going to go, well, then I'm just not going to talk. And all these other things, there's a cause and effect in how we deal with people. In the next verse it says, and they tarried till they were ashamed, and behold, he opened not the doors of the parlor. Therefore they took a key and opened them, and behold, their Lord was fallen down dead on the earth. My personal feeling is Eglon was a very fat man. I'm pretty sure he had a schedule of what food and what time and all that stuff was coming on. And they're like, look, if we don't get him feed him soon, he's going to get really hangry. And when he gets hangry, things just aren't good. You do not want a hungry, angry guy. It just doesn't work out well. It doesn't matter whether it's a husband or a boss. And so they're like, we've got to get the food in there because even if we interrupt him, we're going to be in more trouble for not giving him food. And have you thought about the servants? I mean, here's your whole job. Your entire life is to serve this guy. That's it. That is your job. You walk on there and he's dead on the floor. I'm sure there's blood and guts all over the place too. So it wasn't like a big doubt. He was dead. What about them? Have you thought about what's gone through their hearts and minds? A lot of these cultures, if he dies, guess what? They just kill them all. It's your fault. You should have been there. It's kind of like dads when they have a whole mess of boys. There's a comedian that I was listening to, and I think, was it 8 boys? No, he had more than that, like 10 boys. This dad did. And basically, it's one of those that, the simple rule is if you didn't do it, you knew about it, and you should have stopped it. Kind of a thing. So just beat them all. And, it's that kind of a thing is that here in this particular situation, it could be very likely that all these servants are going to get killed. Why? They failed. They didn't do their job. They're supposed to protect and take care of the king. That is their sole purpose for existence. Can you imagine walking in and seeing your king dead? Who knows how many days, years, decades they've been serving this king. We don't know. But here's the situation. You walk in there and instantaneously everything has changed. And there's going to be a whole lot of stuff going on after, because let's face it, after all this happens, the authorities that come through afterwards, it's like, well, who did it? Who was helping him? Really, you're going to tell me just one guy just walked in here and did all this? He didn't have any help on the inside? That's not normally how it goes. They're going to be looking for those conspiracy theories. Let's turn over to verse 26. And he who escaped while they tarried and passed beyond the quarries and escaped unto Sirath. Once again, the quarries are being mentioned, and so these must have been a major milestone, a major marker on the way. And I'm pretty sure this is probably where the first time Ehud thought he could breathe normally. He's like, I think I'm going to make it. I think I'm going to be okay. I've made it back to the quarries, and I'm heading in another direction. And sometimes life is like that. Sometimes you go through circumstances, you have all this emotion, all this excitement, all this stuff carrying on, but later on there becomes a point where you can just go, okay, now I can settle down. Now I can breathe normally. Now I can think normally. Now I can operate normally. And that doesn't have to be something as traumatic as somebody dies. It can be all sorts of other things. I can remember when I was in the Navy and we'd be doing drills for the nuclear power plant. We'd pretend all these bad things would happen and you have to do all these different jobs. And one of the jobs I had towards the end was load dispatcher. which means I was in charge of the distribution of power throughout the entire ship. So you'd have drills like, you know, a battleship comes and, you know, sticks itself halfway into the side of a carrier. Now what are you going to do? And so you have the entire ship pretending on these drills to deal with stuff. How do you deal with the water? How do you deal with rerouting the power? How do you keep the flight deck operational? How do you keep the planes going off the front? All these other kinds of things. And when you're going through it, you do get hyped up. You know, it's like your brain is moving a lot faster than normal. And that's a way, part of what God made you. But the other thing is you can't stay that way. Eventually your brain's got to kick down out of overdrive. Now, overdrive for some of you people, my first experience of this, I was 16 years old. I'd gotten my first car, and I went out with my Uncle Lorne, and he was going to drive it. It was a 1964 Comet Caliente with a 289 four-barrel, automatic. And so we were driving down there off Logan Hill Road, and I can't remember if it's Yates or whatever the other one is that comes back the other way back down to Jackson Highway. So my Uncle Lorne was going to take it out, and as soon as he turned that corner, he put his foot into it, and then carburetors are an amazing thing. There's four barrels. Most of the time when you're doing stuff, it was only two barrels. You didn't really have to, you know, you could get the four barrels to kick in, and then you had all this fuel coming in. Well, they had another thing called overdrive. Overdrive was if you put your foot into it hard on that transmission, it would kick down a gear and get you going a lot faster, a lot sooner. And I can remember today the exact words that were out of my mom's mouth. Why did you have to show him that? This was new information to me. I didn't know cars did that. I had to try that out on my own, but not when my mom was there. But it did come back to get her later. I later, thanks to my dad, got an 83 Z28, 5-speed, high output, and we were driving. My parents had bought an 84, a white one, very beautiful car, but it was a regular one. It wasn't a high output. And so as I was on Chamberway turning onto the freeway to go north, and my mom said out loud, I don't see any difference between this one and ours. Probably not the wisest choice of words. What did I do? I dropped that thing down a gear, put my foot all the way to the floor, and I popped it in all five gears. So I was doing, well, I didn't have to worry about merge speeds by the time I got into the lane. Let's just put it that way. But I broke the back lane loose on all five gears. And, you know, just showing my mom. My dad thought this was hilarious. He was laughing. My mom did not find any humor whatsoever in that. You know, moms are that way. I'm pretty sure she's still not happy about it. But nonetheless is, we see here that he's got to this position. You have to think that his blood pressure is down a little bit. His heart rate is going back down to normal. And now he's got to think about, well, now what? I mean, he's just killed the king. Let's face it. You have to pretty much expect at this point it's going to be kind of like the Robin Hood thing. Your name's going to be on the little picture, you know, wanted, dead, you know, X amount of money, that kind of stuff going out everywhere for you. You know, all these other thoughts, yes, you had the great victory, but how long before the devil follows right back up and starts putting those seeds of doubt into your mind? Yeah, but they're going to be looking for you. You know, the APB, they're going to be putting it out over the radio. They're going to be looking for you. In the next verse, and it came to pass when he was come that he blew a trumpet in the mountains of Ephraim, and the children of Israel went down with him from the mount, and he before them. Have you wondered what it must have been like to be able to blow a trumpet and have an army show up? Now, I understand it's an army of the Israelites. It's not a real army. Not really. These are mostly all farmers, people like that. But nonetheless, to be able to blow a trumpet and have a whole bunch of people show up. Have you ever thought about what that must have been like? I mean, you're talking about one of the loudest instruments that's out there is the trumpet. That's why they used it in a battle. Why? Because it can cut through all the noise and all the turmoil and all the things going on in battle. You can still hear the trumpet. Now, I played trumpet in high school for a little bit. It's a loud instrument. I'm pretty sure my parents had to use, you know, earplugs, maybe the Mickey Mouse, you know, ear things over your ears and whatever else when I was practicing. Because, you know, let's just face it, there are a lot of instruments. It sounds great to have your kid do it until you have it in your house. And then you get to deal with all the practicing and the problem with the trumpet is you are basically vibrating your lips in order to get the noise to come out. And then how tight you make your lips dictates, you know, I guess, I don't know if it's an octave or whatever it is that you go up, right? And then you also have the little finger things to get the different notes. The likelihood to hit the right note when you're starting out is not very good. It's right up there with the violin or one of the string instruments. You know, it's not like the piano. You may hit the wrong key, but you're hitting a key. It's not that way with a lot of other instruments. You can hit noises that were not expected or determined to be right. And everybody knows that they're not right. It's not like, oh, they just hit the wrong key in the piano. No, you're just wrong. I mean, just totally wrong. You've totally messed it up. And yet, here it's probably made from a ram's horn. And there was only a few notes that could probably be played with it, maybe up to four different notes. And yet, this going out tells Israel, it's time to come. It's time to come. Closest analogy I know of this is my grandma Grimes. She had a bell. When it rang, it meant it's time for you to get to the table. Now. Drop whatever it is that you were doing. If you were a kid, it's time to go. Because there's just no way to win on that. You do not want to show up to Grandma Grimes' table late. She's not going to take that real well. The only thing worse than that was wearing a ball cap in or a cowboy hat into her house. That was rule number one, you never did. Number two was don't show up at the table late when she rings the bell. I mean, you drop it, you go. It doesn't matter what you're doing and how much fun you're doing. It's time to go. Well, imagine you're out there in the field and you're doing whatever and you hear this trumpet blast, and you know it's there. You're being called. It's time to go. It's time for war now. Yeah, but Lord, I'm in the middle of doing it. No, it's time now. Yeah, but I've got this. No, it's time now. Maybe you've seen some of the old movies, like the old westerns and stuff like that. There'd be some old cowboy or some other person. They're out in the middle of nowhere there, and they're surrounded by a bunch of Indians. And pretty soon in the background, you can hear the trumpet blow. And you know, hey, guess what? There's a whole bunch of people wearing blue and have the pistols and the belts. And they had cowboy hats on. And they were going to be riding in to save the day. Can you imagine what it's going to be like when the trumpet does blow and we get out of here? You know, what are you going to be doing when you're doing then? You know, maybe it's just me. It's one of those, Lord, just help me not be doing something stupid. You know, being in church would be great. At least I'm halfway somewhat cleaned up. I'm in a place I'm supposed to be. Hopefully I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And the trumpet blows. Great. I don't know how many hours away from Israel time it is, if that would work out. But, you know, that would be great. You know, that you don't. It's like there's so many other things that could go wrong. What are you doing? I'm gutting a fish in the sink, and the trumpet blows, and you got guts and everything all over you. Oh yeah, thanks, Lord. That's a great timing. Now he's going to clean you all up. Don't worry. I mean, I'm just saying, there's all these other things you could do, and it could have been right after a road rage accident because you're on I-5 and some idiot, you know, who's riding up your rear, finally decided they were going to get over and pass you on whatever side they could find in whatever way, and then they're going to speed up, get around you, and then slow down. And you're like, rumble, 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 rumble. And then the trumpet blows. I mean, there's all sorts of, maybe it's just me. I think that way sometimes. You know, how many times have we sung the song here, Hold the Fort? Hold my comrades, see the signal waving in the sky. Reinforcements now appearing. Victory is nigh. You ever thought what that must have been like? I mean, as great as it's going to be at the rapture, how much more do you think it's going to be for the nation of Israel when the Lord comes back the second time? I mean, after you've been beat down and beaten down and starving and burnt from the sun to your skin's almost black, You are as miserable as a human being as you can possibly think of, and then God shows up, riding the white horse. What an amazing scene. I mean, I am sure that when we get to see that, it's going to exceed anything Hollywood ever dreamed of. There's probably going to be some saved filmmakers that go, man, I wish I could have thought something like that up. So I would have put it in a movie. It would have been a bestseller. Probably had to spend a whole bunch of money on the visual effects, you know, millions and billions of dollars, but it would have been so neat. Or if you read in the book of Joel around chapter 2 with the Lord's army and being able to scale walls and you can't get hurt by weapons. I mean, Have you really put yourself in that situation, what that must be like? Because I don't know about you, I'm at the advanced age now, scaling walls does not seem like fun. There was a period in my life that as a young man, oh yeah, all over it. Yeah, what's on the other side? Let's go. You know, put your fingers in there, jam, you know, find trees, whatever, let's go. Not anymore. Now I'm thinking, no, it's just not worth it. There cannot be anything on that side that exciting that I want to try this, because the odds are not good that it's going to be 100% successful. You know, because what happens if you fall? And you don't even have to fall from that high of a distance anymore. Things just don't bend and operate the same as well as they used to. Bad things can come. It's just not worth it. You know, I've gotten to the advanced age now that I can just wake up in the morning and go, is everything still working right? And I haven't even moved yet. And it's like, do I want to move? I'm not sure. How great it's going to be when God fixes up our body and they're perfect. How many people have gone through their life and have always had some kind of an infirmity? You know, Fanny Crosby, can you imagine being able to see the Lord? What that's going to mean to her? It's going to mean something so much more to her than it is to me. And it shouldn't be that way, but I'm just going to be honest. If you were blind and the first thing you get to see when your eyes get open is the Lord Jesus Christ, it's going to mean a whole lot more to you. How much more of the people that have lost limbs or have been paralyzed their entire life or have had some other difficult thing? Can you imagine what it's going to be like when the trumpet blows and all that stuff changes? What an incredible feeling that's going to be. What excitement for them. You know, like, what's your problem? So I got a bent finger, you know, and God's going to straighten it out. But, you know, other than that, there's not anything more overt. It's not like he's going to have to rebuild a leg like Brother Herzl. You know, sometimes we just don't think about what it must be like in these particular situations. In Judges 3:28, it says, and he said unto them, follow after me, for the Lord hath delivered your enemies, the Moabites, into your hand. And they went down after him and took the fords of the Jordan toward Moab and suffered not a man to pass over. And they slew of Moab at that time about 10,000 men, all lusty and all men of valor, and there escaped not a man. You know, there are a lot of places in history where a small army or a less capable army has gotten a victory. Why? Because of where they're at. Taking advantage of the lay of the land. You can see as a great example from history is the 300. You know, we got 300, and I'm not putting the 300 Spartans down, don't get me wrong. But if they had not picked the right place, we wouldn't be talking about the 300 today. It's only because they picked the right place. Now, they were well-trained. They knew how to do their job. They knew it was a death mission, and they did it. But nonetheless, if they'd chosen the wrong place to do it at, it wouldn't have worked. When you're witnessing to the lost or dealing with the saved and things are going on in their lives, you need to understand the terrain that this person is in. You need to understand the lay of the land. You need to understand with the sword of the Lord, which blade are you going to use, the one that's going to cut or the one that's going to heal? Sometimes you have to help somebody get healed first before you can get them saved. Talk to Brother Walt about that. Sometimes you got to feed somebody. Sometimes you got to minister to somebody. Sometimes you got to win them to yourself before you can get to the part about talking about salvation. You know, understanding that territory, the lay of the land, is a good thing. In Jeremiah 29:11-12, it's where God says, I know the thoughts that I think towards you, saith the Lord. I mean, that alone, you can skip the rest of the verse. Can you imagine that God cares about what you're thinking? You, every single one of you, every single person, no matter where they are, God cares about what you're thinking. He cares about what's going on in your mind. And he says, by the way, I've got thoughts of peace that I think about you. Is that what the devil thinks about you? Thoughts of peace? I don't think so. Is that what your government officials have towards you? Thoughts of peace? I don't think so. Sometimes not even your own family members have thoughts of peace towards you, but God does. He wants you to have a peace that surpasses all understanding. It's not peace as the world has. It's God's peace. See, that's the hard problem is, you know, I think a lot of the Bible would be a lot more understandable if God didn't use words that we've messed up the definitions for. If we actually use the definitions for the words as they really are, how much better maybe we would understand some things. Romans chapter 1 verse 20 says, "For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world, God put things in at the beginning of the world for you to see that he made, I don't know how many thousand years ago." God does. But he put them there, why? So that you would see him and know that he is God. Have you thought about something so trivial? And I've said this before, I'm sorry you live in the Pacific Northwest. And if you never leave here, there's something that on vacation, you need to go to the Midwest, away from a big city sometime, and just look up. And just look up. Because you will see the sky. Here's my closest analogy. A certain Mrs. Johnson puts up this beautiful blue piece of paper. And then let's say it's like 12 feet long and 10 feet high. And she just leaves it out there. And pretty soon, say, I don't know, two or three boys, one of them happens to find a pin or something like that and goes up and just pops a hole in it and notices that light comes through from the other side. And she probably knows which one I'm thinking of at this point in time, at which point I think there's going to be a little bit of excitement in this young boy is that he has just learned something new and now it's time to investigate this scientifically. Will this experiment repeat if I poke another hole and another hole and another hole? And then if you've got brothers, hey, they're just going to join in. Sometimes sisters too. Can you imagine the whole Johnson household? Everybody's got their little tack or pin and they're just stabbing holes all over the place. And you come in and there's just more holes than there is blue anymore. That's what it's like to live in the West and look up and see what God created. That's the closest thing that I can tell you it looks like. It looks like there are stars everywhere. It's not like out here you look up and yeah, you see a few. Oh, that's nice. You know, whatever. It's totally different if you can get away from where there's the light pollution and the clouds and all the other stuff. In Judges 3 verse 29, "And they slew of Moab at that time about 10,000 men." I don't know how many Israelites were there. But I want you to think about the other group for a little bit first. You got 10,000 men. They're all lusty. Now, the Webster's 1828 dictionary says that this is stout, vigorous, robust, healthful, able of body. This is the correct sense of the word. I kind of found that interesting when I was reading it. And this is from 1828. That even back then they had to tell you this is what the word really means. Comprehending full health and strength as a lusty youth. Valor, strength in mind in regard to danger, that quality which enables a man to encounter danger with firmness, personal bravery, courage, intrepidity, and prowess. I want you to put yourself for the minute. There's 10,000 of you. You are a soldier. You're going up against farmers. You're trained. This is what you do. They had to believe in their heart of hearts that this is going to be, you know, this is easy duty. I mean, we just got to wipe up this Israelites. We can go home. Back the same way it's always been. Nothing new under the sun. But I wanted you to think about the character of these men, that they all died. All of them. What kind of character do you have? Do you have a character to stand and fight when you start seeing the odds stacked against you? When you thought what were everything in your advantage and now it's flipped the other way? Can you imagine being the last 100, 50, 10, 1? Every single one of them died fighting. All of them. There wasn't anybody there. It's like, you know, we started off with 10,000. We're now down into, you know, we're in five digits now. Where's the exit? How do I get off this stage? How do I run for my life to get away from here? It wasn't that way. These men, think what you want. Look at the character of these men. They all died. All 10,000 of them. Yes, God gave the Israelites a great victory, but I want you to see the character of these men, that even in losing, they were showing you their character. How about you, Christian? Do you show the lost world your character when you're losing? Or what do you show them? How much Christianity do you have when you're losing? And now, I'm not going to give you my personal score of wins and losses on this. Let's just say that it's probably, you know, I wouldn't get hired by any professional team with my wins and losses record. Let's just put it that way. But have you thought about it yourself and put yourself in that same position? If people watched you and watched you in a lose situation, would they say, hey, he lost with some character? Or would they say, you're just like everybody else? You're acting the same way. You're saying the same things. Your body language is the same, you know, just same, same, same. You're just no different than anybody else. And we're going to end here in verse 30. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest 80 years. Have you ever thought about this? How long were they in bondage? Does anybody remember? Nope. Yeah, under Eglon. 18 years. They were under bondage for 18 years. When they get the victory, God gives them how many years of peace and rest? 80. 80. Yeah, they had to. Yeah, it was bad for 18 years. Guess what? And then God gave them rest for 80 years. We're not seeing anything about a spiritual hope. You know, there was such a revival. I mean, there's this prophet that came out right after this, and he preached to people, and they were just falling in the aisles. We had to mop up the floor. There were so many tears on the floor. It was such a great revival meeting. We don't even see anything about revival here. We just see that God gave them rest. How about you, Christian? I don't know how many years of difficulty you've had in bondage to whatever, or other difficulties in your life. But God kind of made me think about this. How are you going to compare that to eternity when God gives you rest for eternity? Yeah, I don't know how long you've been alive. Let's even say it's 100 years. Let's say you had 100 years of bondage and difficulty here on this earth, and then God takes you home and he gives you eternity. How does that compare? Yeah, you had some difficulty, but here's eternity. It doesn't end. You can't put a number on it. I know as a kid, this is one that really bugged me for a while, and then I thought it was kind of cool because then you could tease other kids with it. What's infinity plus one? You know, all sorts of things like that. Okay, have you thought what that's going to be like to be with the Lord forever? To have real peace forever? To have all of the physical issues maybe you've gone with forever taken care of. All the mental issues maybe you've dealt with or emotional issues you've dealt with taken care of forever. That's what God has for you. And then yet we kind of complain and, you know, like, Lord, why am I in this? And believe me, I'm probably the poster child for it. And then, but yet God says, but I have thoughts for you that are of peace. You just might have to wait a little while. Yeah, you may not have 100% peace in whatever's going on with your life right now. You may have a tough stretch. Let's face it, a lot of things are difficult in life. You don't think so? Just pull out our prayer requests. Come on Thursday night if you don't, and listen to some of the prayer requests that come through. Look at the emails that come through. Let's face it, if I had the ability to just be like the Apostle Paul and fix things up by, hey, here's my jacket. Take it with you. Just, you know, rub it over the person who's sick. They're healed. How great that would be. But God says that's not the way it's supposed to go. You're supposed to live by faith. Now, that also means sometimes we get to the point like, oh, that means God doesn't do miracles anymore. No, he still does miracles. The problem is we don't see them. We've got so hardened by the world and the circumstances in our life, we can't see the small little things of God moving. Because sometimes his greatest miracles are in the small things. Yeah, we'd all like to be there in Egypt and say, ooh, Red Sea, you know, poke the water, you know, whatever it is for you, walk on dry land all the way over. You know, all that kind of stuff. We'd all like to see that. But yet we ignore all the little miracles that go on. Maybe that miracle that, hey, you had a car problem so you can go to work to that day. Why? Because if you did, you would have been in a car accident. You know, just something little. Maybe you go out there and you start your car and you get one of the, and then click, 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 click. It's like whatever you thought you were going to be doing right now probably isn't going to happen. That might be the Lord just doing a little something for you. Maybe there's an appointment that you had to go to that you were looking forward to and got canceled. Why? Maybe God was just doing a little something for you. Because we're not looking for it. It's very difficult to see the small things if you're not looking for it. You're not going to see God's hand moving in somebody's life if you're just like, you know, looking all over the place. You have to be paying attention. It's like watching a plant grow. Because just let's face it, most plants are not like that one weed down in the south that they got kudzu or whatever it is. Like you can watch it really grow. It's like as a kid, you know, you plant it in this little styrofoam cup and you're sitting there and goes, nothing is happening. It's dirt. Right? That's us in our Christian life. We don't see what's going on underneath the ground and see that this seed is coming to life. We don't see what goes on in the heart of men. We don't see the little things where God moves and directs and protects and heals and strengthens and all these other things. And what happens? Then we get discouraged because we don't see the big things. And God's going, if you could only see all the things going on around you, this wouldn't be an issue. You want the big thing because you don't want to look for the little thing because it's hard. And, you know, in order to look for that little thing, that means you have to be kind of aware of something that's going on. You need to be praying about it. You need to be asking God to move in this person's life. Because there's always those prayer requests that come through. It's not like we have an issue where a pastor's going, you know what? You know, we already been here on Thursday night for 2 hours with all the prayer requests. I think we're going to have to call it now. That doesn't happen. Now, we do have to worry about how long we go in the prayer thing because there are kids that are going to be let loose in the other building. So you got to be a little sensitive to time. But nonetheless, there's always needs. And as long as there's needs on this earth, that means God's moving. Maybe not in the way that we want. Maybe he's just going to give them peace. Maybe he's just going to give them that internal strength they need. But he may not answer the prayer request the way that we want. But I think if we saw a lot more of the little things that going on, I think it would really change our spiritual walk with the Lord if we could see the little things. Lord, as we close in prayer, I pray for each person here. I pray for each person that's watching on the webcast, Lord, that your Holy Spirit would be just minister to them, Lord. Help them, bless them, and encourage them, strengthen them. Lord, minister to the needs that are on their hearts and their minds, Lord. And many times, Lord, these needs are not needs of their own. They're for someone else. And I just pray, Lord, that your Holy Spirit would just give them the peace that they need, the strength, Lord, to deal with the situation, Lord, and just put their trust and hope in you and just let you move, Lord. And let's give you all the praise and all the glory for how great you truly are. And we thank you for all these things and all the things you've already done in our life, Lord, that we're not even aware of. In the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, we pray. Amen.